Okay, last week we announced a pregnancy.
Yes, if you missed it.
And today, another announcement.
Yes, another big announcement.
I have pneumonia.
Yes.
I'm actually feeling a lot better today.
I'm going to leave that cough in.
Yeah, you
should. For effect.
But no, I feel a lot better now. But yeah, it's been an interesting couple of weeks.
Yes.
And hopefully everything will be like great from now on.
And as our marquee here says, if you're not watching on YouTube, Sleepless in New Jersey is pretty applicable to this week's episode.
Yeah, I've got some pregnancy insomnia as well as some steroid pack insomnia.
How do they keep convincing people to have babies?
It's crazy, right?
How is this? How does this work? How does,
because giving birth is really fun and postpartum is like super fun.
Yeah, at least you have a great time at the end of it.
Exactly. That's why.
No, I'm actually joking, because at least on my end, our son is now 18 months old.
Yes.
Which, if you've been following us from the beginning, that's pretty crazy, right? Because
it is pretty crazy.
You hadn't even had our baby, but you know, our first few episodes.
Mm-hmm. Ignorance is bliss.
He is the best.
Birth process.
He's the best now.
Oh, he's the best.
Just for the record.
Yeah, he's my BFF.
So yeah, whenever he hears this, he'll probably be embarrassed, because by the time he's old enough to probably listen to the episodes, he'll be like, guys, you had a podcast?
It's so embarrassing.
That's so embarrassing. But yeah, he's great, and the next baby will hopefully also be great, but
even if he's not, we'll love him just the same.
Yeah. Pneumonia, not great.
Pneumonia, 0 out of 10, do not recommend.
I'm the only human in this house who has not had some effects of pneumonia in the past like 3 months. So
it's true. Yep.
So yeah, I'm going to hopefully keep that streak going.
Yeah.
All right. Episode time.
We got another Efron.
Yes. Not Zach.
Oh, no.
No.
We'll do another Zach Efron soon, I'm sure.
Iron Claw, maybe.
17 again. I'm Aaron.
I'm Tom.
And this is Baby's First Watch List, forcing Tom to watch romantic comedies over and over.
I've never had a problem with romantic comedies. I just never watched them.
Well, and you don't like a lot of them.
I don't like a lot of them.
You like this one, though.
I liked it. I thought I was going to like it more.
Ooh.
In the middle of the movie, I thought I was going to like it more than I ended up liking it.
All right. We'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Today, we are discussing a classic, 1993's Sleepless in Seattle. Nora Ephron directed this one, and she co-wrote it with David S. Ward, and Jeff Arch is also given credit for it as well. Arch was a twice-nominated screenwriter for this and 20 years prior for The Sting.
Oh, wow.
And when I first read that, I was like, that's a little interesting, because this movie is very, very different from that.
Is The Sting Paul Newman?
Yes, but it'll make sense in a little bit.
Okay.
Ephron was thrice nominated. This was her last nomination for the Oscars. She also netted noms for writing When Harry Met Sally and Silkwood, which was the first movie that she did write.
Wow.
Cinematographer Sven Nykvist,
a Swede.
A Swede, and a very big collaborator with Ingmar Bergman.
A Swede.
Who, and this guy, Sven, was also, he's seen as like one of the greatest cinematographers ever to a lot of people.
Okay.
He had previously won 2 Oscars for shooting Cries and Whispers and Fanny and Alexander.
Yeah.
So, and he did this one, which is cool. EGT winner, meaning Emmy, Grammy, Tony winner, Mark, is it Shaman or Shyman?
I don't know.
He did the music, and we have talked about him before, as he did the music for Misery and When Harry Met Sally.
Okay.
He's been nominated for 7 Oscars, but hasn't won any. If he wins an Oscar, he'll get that EGOT.
Is he still working?
I think so. Original song for this movie was actually his first nomination. And he was robbed for another one of his best original, what?
Just the way that you said that.
He was robbed, not really, because he lost to You'll Be in My Heart by Phil Collins, but for Tarzan. But he was robbed.
I see what
for
it is.
Best original song. He wrote Blame Canada from South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Yes, yes.
So
that is a robbery.
That's a robbery.
I'm sorry to Phil. Shout out Phil.
That's the thing. I really like when when the Oscars give like best original song to like 3-6 Mafia.
Yeah.
Like, I love that.
At the time, 3-6 Mafia had more Oscars than Martin Scorsese.
We should do that more. Like, Blame Canada should have won the Oscar.
1,000%. Also should have won the Oscar, See You Again, Wiz Khalifa and Charlie Puth.
Which wasn't even nominated.
Was not even nominated for Furious 7.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute outrage.
That's like, this year, I'm Just Ken should win. It's not going to.
It's not going to win.
Billie Eilish is going to win. Which, that movie, or that song is beautiful. But I'm Just Ken should win.
It should.
I just think best original song, let's make it fun and flirty.
Well, let's make it fun, but let's also make it like a vital part of the movie. Blame Canada is vital to South Park. It really is.
I've never seen it. I've never seen it. So this movie was originally conceived by Jeff Arch as a drama.
Yes.
Inspired by the movie An Affair to Remember. That's why it makes sense that he was nominated for The Sting, which is definitely more of a drama.
Yes.
And then, yeah, he originally wrote this as a drama. Efron and Ward.
The Sting is like a caper movie.
Yeah.
It's not like a drama.
No, but it's not like.
Right.
So Efron and Ward, they came on board to rewrite the script to make it more funny. And so Efron stepped in as director. Do you know who was originally supposed to direct this?
I think I read it, but I can't remember.
Nicholas Castle. Do you know who he was?
No.
He might still be alive. I think he's still alive. So he left because he didn't want to make a comedy. He thought that the new script kind of stripped the emotion from the movie, whatever. And originally, Castle was given Sleepless in Seattle as sort of a consolation because he was originally supposed to direct Hook. And then Steven Spielberg was like, I'll direct Hook. And they're like, oh, sorry, man. Here, you can do this one. And then he left that too. Do you know? Did it click yet who he is?
No.
Michael Myers.
Oh,
he
yeah.
He is the guy who plays Michael Myers in all the Halloween movies.
Castle.
Yeah, right? And he also directed Dennis the Menace, which came out the same day as Sleepless in Seattle.
I was thinking Castle, like the French.
No. He was like, oh, okay, cool. You guys are taking this away from me. I'll direct Dennis the Menace.
Yes.
And then you'll all be sorry.
I'll show you.
Yeah. So, starring Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks, and with a great supporting cast, including Bill Pullman.
Yes.
Rosie O'Donnell.
I'm going to talk about Bill Pullman.
Yes. Rosie O'Donnell, Rita Wilson, Victor Garber. We even got a Gabby Hoffman appearance.
Gabby Hoffman's like low-key great in this movie.
Oh, she's great. Sleepless in Seattle was... Oh, and Rob Reiner, too. I didn't write down Rob Reiner.
Yeah.
Sleepless in Seattle was filmed mostly in Seattle in 1992. And the movie premiered to relatively good reviews the following June. It came in a surprise second to Jurassic Park at the box office. And it ended up being a huge hit, with it being the highest opening box office weekend for a romantic comedy up until that point.
Wow. That's
which is legit. Really impressive. Especially because back then, up until that point, like, there haven't been that many romantic comedies. Like, so it's like a lot of movies that they had
to be.
Well,
there were, but... There were not for too long. There aren't any anymore. There aren't many anymore.
Yeah, right.
It was probably like another 15 years.
Yeah, because like you got
years.
All the McConaughey, Kate Hudson yeah. stuff. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So it ended up making $227.9 million on a $21 million budget.
That's profit.
That's mega bank.
That's profit.
It was nominated for 2 Oscars, screenplay and best original song. It did lose both.
Hanks was up for the Globe, right?
Hanks and Ryan and the movie were up for the Globe.
Yep. Yeah.
So Sleepless in Seattle, since 1993, has really secured 2 legacies. It is considered a really classic romantic comedy, especially with these 2 leads being like God tier when it comes
to romantic comedy canon.
Uh-huh, exactly. And an equally important in my life, legacy that Sleepless in Seattle was able to accomplish.
Is there something Housewives related?
No. It actually is given credit for introducing tiramisu to American audiences.
Wow.
Because you remember that scene with Rob Reiner where they're talking about tiramisu and comparing it to something else?
Yes.
Like,
and Hanks has no idea what tiramisu is.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of like, I thought it was like, ha ha, quaint. Like, of course he should know what that is. No, nobody apparently knew what it was.
Strange.
And it kind of introduced it and it became popular after that.
I thought it was a joke to parallel how Pullman didn't know what dim sum was.
Yeah, no, apparently. Well, maybe. Like, dim sum wasn't a popular food category back then. So one little humble brag here in my Wikipedia research.
Humble brag in my Wikipedia research.
So I found something out that I called. So when we were watching the movie, there is a babysitter, Clarice, right? And I saw Clarice for 2 seconds. And what did I compare? Who did I compare her to?
I don't know.
I said, oh, look at the Shelley Duvall over here. Oh, right? Apparently, while casting Clarice, Nora Ephron wanted a Shelley Duvall type.
That is funny.
So there you go. I called it.
No confirmation on whether it's a Silence of the Lambs reference?
No, there is none. Okay. No, I looked for that too.
Okay.
And then I have a couple of New Jersey connections.
Yeah.
First, Mark Shyman or Shaman, our music god, he was born in Newark.
Okay, yeah.
So we got the music.
Shout out Newark.
Newark. And then two times New Jersey was mentioned. And New Jersey was mentioned almost like a joke, which is like so rude, but like
we're
whatever.
Used to it. It's all good.
Yeah. So the radio station, when Meg Ryan is driving during Christmas Eve, they mention that the Cape Mayettes, I think it was, or something like that, were about to sing Jingle Bells Sung Backwards. And Meg Ryan's parents in the movie, they met in Atlantic City. And that started their love story. And so if they had never met in the beautiful, beautiful town of Atlantic City.
Do you have a line from the Bruce song or no?
None of those lines would be positive.
No.
I love that song, but no. no.
Maybe I'll play a portion of it right here for you.
Put your makeup on, fix your hair up pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City.
What I'm gonna do is put it in right here as a comparison to your rendition.
Put your makeup on, fix your hair up pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City.
The live version. Because that's the version I was singing, not the original. The original, it will sound nothing like that if you play, because it'll sound exactly the same if you play the live 100%. Version.
Never mind. Okay, go ahead.
So if they had never met in Atlantic City, Meg Ryan's character never would have existed.
And then, ipso facto, this movie would have never existed.
You just got connected for free. New Jersey connection. All right, that's all I got.
All right, I have a little plot synopsis. I added a little bit to it because it was too bare. It was like some rando put it up to IMDb. All right. So Sam Baldwin is played by Tom Hanks. His wife dies, and he decides to move to Seattle with his son, Jonah. What's the actor's name? Do you remember?
Nope.
Okay. When Jonah sees how sad his father is, he calls a radio psychiatrist, which is a hilarious concept.
Yeah, it really is.
Who dubs him Sleepless in Seattle because Jonah says that Sam can't sleep.
Vibes.
Sam starts to talk about his wife to the radio psychiatrist, and women all around the country hear his tale. One woman, Annie Reed, played by Meg Ryan, who lives in Baltimore, can't help but be fascinated by his tale. Literally like stalkery.
She's like sobbing.
Annie, despite being engaged to Walter, played by Bill Pullman. I love Walter so much. Can't stop thinking of Sam, and soon tries to find out all she can. She even goes to Seattle to see him.
And I know that when the original screenwriter was writing this, he referenced really researched a Washington Post article about women who used private investigators to find information on possible suitors.
Wow.
So there is background to it. It didn't just come out of nowhere.
Yeah. Nora kept it in, so.
Yeah.
Once Annie gets off the plane, Sam, who was in the airport to see off the woman he was sort of casually dating, sees her and can't keep his eyes off her. He tries to follow her but can't catch her. He actually kind of stops, too. He's like,
whatever. Yeah, because he's not crazy like she is.
Yeah, he's not flying 3,000 miles across the country to see her.
Right.
Until he does at the end. But,
that's true. No, he does have first son.
Yeah. Jonah, who has been going through the mail that his father has gotten ever since he was on the radio, sees the letter Annie wrote him on a whim. She hadn't actually sent it, but her friend, was it Becky? Played by Rosie O'Donnell. Let's say Becky, played by Rosie O'Donnell, did. The letter asks for Sam to meet Annie at the top of the Empire State Building on Valentine's Day. Normal behavior for people who have never met.
But it's based on an affair to remember.
She didn't say that, though, in the letter.
No.
She just said, we're going to... meet me at the Empire State Building.
Listen.
Jonah tells his father this could be it. But Sam doesn't think he could have a relationship with someone who lives so far away. Eventually, with Valentine's Day coming up, on the advice of his friend Jessica, played by Gabby Hoffman,
who's like 10,
Jonah decides to go to New York by himself. Didn't he upgrade to first class? Or she like bought him a Jessica like bought him a first class ticket. Sam finds out, and obviously he takes the first flight out to New York
in coach.
In coach. Annie and Walter, her literal fiance, are at a fancy dinner in New York when she sees the Empire State Building light up with a heart. She then tells Walter all about Sam, and Walter's basically like,
oh, okay.
All right, sure, see ya. Sam, Jonah, and Annie meet atop the Empire State Building, realizing who each other are, and they all leave together. That's Sleepless in Seattle, baby.
No kiss at the end.
No kiss at the end.
Yeah, interesting. Hanks and Meg Ryan have a total of like 2 minutes of screen time
yes.
together.
That was in one of my, that's one of my trivias.
So, oh, sorry.
No, I mean,
which is so interesting.
Working into the convo.
Rewatching this movie, I liked it, I think, more than I liked it the first time, because for me, the first time I saw it, I really focused on the romance aspect of it. And that, I understand it's a romantic comedy, but it's really not about the romance as much as you would think. I really like now watching it from the aspect of like a grieving father and son and their relationship, plus kind of individually seeing people growing and kind of following two really interesting, charming people.
It's about neuroses.
Yeah.
On
yeah.
both ends.
Yeah, totally. So I really enjoyed rewatching this movie. Okay. So my first question here, this movie, you got to suspend some, you know, reality when
much
you're watching
of it, much of it.
But there are some realistic aspects of it. I want to know, what do you think was the most realistic and most unrealistic part about the, or thing about this movie?
What I found realistic was the way that Sam talks with Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he does really well at putting on a brave face. Like, Hanks is excellent in this movie.
He is.
I'm not the biggest Tom Hanks fan in the entire universe, but I think this is one of his stronger performances.
I love him.
Or
this.
At least one of his more unique performances. And he just, this role kind of falls apart if you don't have somebody who can play those sort of shades.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a fully developed person from the first second you lay eyes on, just by the way that he's like walking around and the way that he's kind of like moping, but he knows that when you have a kid, like, you're not, you can't mope. You have no time to mope. Like, mm-hmm. if you want your kid to grow up somewhat healthy. And then, you know, of course he's overwhelmed by being a single dad, or a widow. Is it still widowed or is it widowered? It's still widowed.
It's that's a joke.
Oh,
in the movie.
They said, I was like, where did I get that from?
It's a literal joke in the movie.
It's widowed.
It's widowed.
Yeah. Right. So the way that he plays that is he has a lot of urgency. Like when he sees, Jonah hanging out with Jessica and they're listening to the Beatles song.
Yeah.
What song is it when you play it backwards?
It's Paul is Dead.
It's Paul is Dead, whatever song it is. And he's realizing in that moment, he's like, I got to like get this kid a mom. This kid needs like a female like authority figure in his life. That's going to.
Which he, if he had stayed in Chicago, he does have those. Like he has
this
Rita
sister.
Wilson. Yeah.
Yeah.
But moving to Seattle, yeah, he's kind of by himself in this. And
yeah.
It's hard.
But you can sort of, I love the way that the story develops like in that sense. I think that are you going to ask what's the most unrealistic or did you?
I did.
Okay. The most unrealistic is every single thing that happens in Annie's storyline. Every single thing from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
Walter is allergic to everything.
Yeah.
Literally everything. He's got a gluten allergy. He's got like he's just allergic to something at the dinner with the family. Yeah. He's like allergic to fish too. It's like he's allergic to everything. I mean, obviously the point is like he's like allergic to her. Like there's something wrong in the relationship.
Right.
But he, you know, that whole like character trait of his. Then you have Annie literally stalking this guy from across the country, whose voice she heard on the radio. It's just, it really, by the end, I was like, okay. Like, I suspended my disbelief. I got here. And then we're at the point where she tells Walter everything about Sam. And Walter literally says something to the effect of, like, why would I start a marriage with such low expectations? So, mm-hmm. It's like some line like that. And he's like, yeah, sure, just give me the ring back, which was his mother's ring that he had like recustomized to fit her. He brought her to this super nice restaurant in the big city, the Big Apple, on Valentine's Day.
Yep.
And he orders a Dom DeLuise. It's like a little joke he makes when he orders the Dom Perignon champagne.
It's so good. I love that.
It's
little
so like
stuff.
Cheesy.
I love that.
And she literally looks out the window at the Empire State Building, sees a little red heart come up because it's Valentine's Day, and whatever intern plugged that into the electric electrical panel. And he's like, "Yeah, sure, like whatever, just go, you know, live your truth with this dude who you've literally never met."
Mm-hmm.
And he was totally fine with it, and he walked off, and he was as chipper as ever.
Yep.
And that to me makes absolutely no sense. It was the capper of an entire storyline for almost 2 hours that made absolutely no sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my most unrealistic.
Yeah, I think that's good. My most and least realistic thing is connected to the same plot point. So Jonah is the one, the son is the one that finds Meg Ryan's letter. And so he writes it back as Sam, right? As his dad. And so when Meg Ryan's reading the letter out loud, it reads like a 9-year-old wrote it.
Right.
Right. You are neat. I think you are neat. Stuff like that. And so the most realistic thing is that she kind of gets the ick for a second where she's like, I don't know if I like that. But the least realistic thing is that she continues to have a crush on him.
It's a little bit like Freaky Friday.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Although
the
like,
opposite. It's the opposite.
Who is going to not like Mark Harmon? All right. So do you want to wait for your deep dive to sing the praises of unsung hero Bill Pullman in this movie?
Yeah.
All right. We'll wait on that.
I do.
Because that was like you loved Walter.
Walter was insane.
I completely forgot he was in the movie.
He's the best.
And he's
I
so
also
good.
Have a predisposition to love Bill Pullman because Spaceballs was one of my favorite movies growing up, and
there
he's the main guy in Spaceballs. So you know, he was great in Independence Day, which we covered. He was the president in Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
He's just one of those actors that I really like.
Yeah,
whenever he pops up
good.
And stuff,
he's good.
And he's always playing something different. Like in Spaceballs, he played like kind of like an outlaw type. In Independence Day, again, he played the president who goes in to like save the day in the freaking plane at the end.
Big speech.
Yeah. And then in this, he's like a loser. He's like the safe, nice guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He's not really a loser because he's
no,
got a
he's
good
a nice
job.
Guy.
Yeah, nice guy.
All right. So Nora Ephron is probably best known for writing this movie and When Harry Met Sally. So I want to know which couple you think had the better chemistry, Meg Ryan and Hanks in this one or Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal in When Harry Met Sally?
Well, strangely enough, I will tell you that going into this movie, I didn't realize how little chemistry Ryan and Hanks would have because they're not in the movie together.
They're not.
I would say that definitely Crystal and Ryan have more chemistry because they're in the whole movie together.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they sort of come in and out of each other's lives, they talk. All I can think of from that movie are the conversations between Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan. Like that's what I think of. What else can you think of? You could think of Carrie Fisher being dumb with the guy, but
yes.
Like, it's just they are the movie,
right?
And this one, Hanks and Ryan are the movie, but they're the movie in their own ways,
mm-hmm.
in their own separate like storylines.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it would be fair to say that Hanks and Ryan have more chemistry because they're on screen for two minutes together. One of them is an awkward hello when she's standing in the middle of the street, and the other one is the end where they just kind of stare at each other,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't like the ending. Spoilers,
right,
for my opinion. But like, I definitely, it's got to be When Harry Met Sally.
So why then do you think that this is considered a top tier romantic comedy?
Let's say there's three reasons. One of the reasons is the fact that Hanks and Meg Ryan are just
so likable.
They're so well cast. Mm-hmm. And it takes a special talent. Again, I'm crapping on Annie's character, but it takes a special talent like Meg Ryan to make this character likable.
And she's very likable.
She's very likable. And like someone said, like, imagine if the genders were reversed. Like, this would be a horror movie.
Yeah, totally.
But Meg Ryan is just so great at playing like quirky, like kind of like ditzy, but not really.
Yeah, and like the girl that like you would want to be friends with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
like I would totally be friends with her.
And everything she does is so like altruistic. Like she kind of screws over Walter, but you know.
Yeah, but still, like I think that she just wasn't in it and she didn't go about it the right way, but she like, it's for the best for everybody. And she wasn't mean about it.
Right.
You know.
And like I said, Hanks is Hanks. But number two is the fact that it's a unique premise that, in the way, comparing it again to When Harry Met Sally, in a way that When Harry Met Sally was very maximalist with how much interaction they had, this was so sparse.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, do they, will they, won't they? Obviously, you know that they probably will. But, like, what is the end goal here? And when they get together, finally, it's like, okay, we don't need to see anything that happens after that. Whereas we know with When Harry Met Sally, there's the whole premise of, you know, can friends, you know, stay for, can a man and a woman be friends, or do they have to end up in a relationship, or mm-hmm. have a crush on each other or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that one could have gone either way.
Right.
This one, the way that they were discussing magic and movies and mm-hmm. fate, like, you were pretty sure that they were going to get together at the mm-hmm. end. But you wanted to see how it happened.
Right.
And I think that's another thing. And the third thing is how great and strong the supporting cast is.
Mm.
Because if you have these two not talking the entire movie, not on screen the entire movie, you have to have a rock solid supporting cast. And like I said, they had Pullman. Rosie O'Donnell was great as Annie's friend. She's great. And listen, Rosie O'Donnell, you may have your opinions on Rosie O'Donnell. I don't know. But she's everything I watch her in. She's good.
Great.
She's great in A League of Their Own. She's always good. The Rob Reiner scenes.
Great.
With Hanks were great. Those two have excellent chemistry.
I would
together.
Like so marry Rob Reiner. Like,
I don't know
him.
What that says about. She's also a Gandolfini gal. So
yeah. Those are my two crushes.
So I don't know what that means.
Rob Reiner and James Cranston.
I don't know.
I'm like not even joking.
And we're not talking about All in the Family when he had hair.
No. I'm talking about like Rob Reiner. Like, you know Rob Reiner.
Yikes.
And I'm talking like Tony Soprano in The Robe.
Like season four.
Like, he's not doing well. I'm like, Tony's looking good this season.
Like White Caps episode. He's like fighting with Carmella.
Okay, no, not that episode. That's pretty bad.
But those are my three things I think that put this movie in that sort of canon. Is it one of my favorites ever? I thought it was really funny at times, but the ending kind of took me out of it.
Fair.
But I could. That's why I think that people in general have it in their tops.
Good answer. One of the things about this movie that I really like is the initial premise of, you know, she's driving and she hears this guy on the radio, like in that Ask Delilah kind of thing of like her or him spilling his life story and being so vulnerable, and then like her like falling in love with him that way. I think that is so cute and such a like kind of just quaint premise. I also think that that's really relatable. Like, I feel like everyone has like heard somebody say something, be like, wait, am I in love with this person that I've never met before? Because they say something so nice. Like, you've never had that happen?
I've never had that happen.
Where, like, someone... Where there's
go
a...
off.
Well, whatever. So, obviously, nowadays, that's probably not going to happen, where there's a very popular nighttime radio show that people happen to tune into, right? So, what's the modern day take on this?
You haven't gotten fan letters from our podcast?
No.
Well, I have, and let me tell you. No, that's the... It's podcasts. Because... The same type of people who are listening to this radio show are the people who listen to podcasts now.
Mm-hmm.
The millennials, the millennial version of listening to the late night psychiatry podcasts are listening to true crime podcasts now.
Mm.
That's what I think it is. I think it's people listening to freaking My Favorite Murder or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, if you know, or whatever. What's the whatever the one? Is that the one that does all like the movie, like the documentaries?
True Crime Obsessed.
True Crime Obsessed.
Oh, we're not shouting them out.
A hypothetical true crime podcast that goes through documentaries or through real stories with real interviews with real people.
Right.
Something like that, where you hear somebody talking and they have a certain perspective on something that hits you in a certain way. And that's it. I mean, to me, it's podcasts. What do you think?
I kind of agree with you, because I feel like our friend Robbie's DMs are on fire.
Oh, they should be.
And Robbie obviously has a very popular podcast.
A Lot About Nothing.
That's right.
Robbie also was on our Shining episode.
He was. And Robbie.
And will be on our Swingers episode whenever we drop it.
Yes. And Robbie's podcast a lot of times talks about being single in the city and things like that. And so I think that he probably gets a lot of people in his messages that are like, wait, I'm obsessed with you.
And he should. Robbie's great.
Oh, he's great. I hope. Please send him DM. No, don't actually send him DMs unless you know him. But I think you're right. I think it's that. I think it's that someone's listening in their ears to something, and there's someone that, you know, you're just like, I feel like almost like that parasocial relationship.
Oh yeah,
where you feel like you know them, and you're like, okay, I think I could be in love with this person if they only knew me and we dated and whatever. And that's kind of where Meg Ryan was at. I keep calling her Meg Ryan. Annie.
I also Annie Reed is a great name. I also feel
so
like
Sam Baldwin. It's a great.
Yeah. I also feel like this is how people get involved on, like, on a similar note, get involved with people who are in jail.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Right?
Definitely. Well, you can like look that up on the internet, like people who are incarcerated that want to have pen pals and stuff.
And get letters, yeah.
Yeah. You could do that, which don't do that probably.
Unless you want to.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Okay. My last question is connected to the romantic love part of this movie, which is, like we mentioned before, grief, is a major theme. And I found it to be the most affecting part of this movie. So what I like is that grief in this movie is handled in a way that is, not necessarily lighthearted, but with a purpose of like approaching things with humor and with, you know, possibility can lead to hope later on, you know? And I like that about this movie a lot. So
well, what's the quote that the psychiatrist says? It's something like people who have loved are far more likely to love again.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very hopeful message there. What are some other, well, I want to give you some of mine and then I'll ask
you
for
want.
Some.
This is your show.
I do everything around here. No. I want to know about some great movies about grief, or maybe movies about grief that maybe we didn't love but might be good for somebody.
Go for it.
First one, I'm not going to talk about it, but Pieces of a Woman.
Yes.
Is great. Very, very affecting, but I don't want to talk about it.
It at
right
least
now.
Has a as an affecting scene, an affecting sequence.
I found it to be a really good movie. Manchester by the Sea has kind of an opposite message.
Okay.
Of how
I don't really I watched it when it came out, but I remember some parts of it, but I don't remember like what the like the theme like I wasn't
yeah. In so that spoilers mode yet. Ahead here if you haven't seen like 2000 like what 13's Manchester maybe later 15
16
yeah Manchester by the Sea. Casey Affleck is this hard-nosed custodian who you know, lives in Boston in this like basement apartment.
Lives in Manchester by the Sea.
No, he doesn't.
No,
he lives
goes
in,
to Manchester.
He goes
by the
to
sea,
Manchester right? by the Sea. His brother dies, Kyle Chandler.
Yes.
And he kind of is in charge of now taking care of Kyle Chandler's son, who is played by Lucas Hedges.
Yes.
And he's not doing a good job at it.
He's not good at it.
He's not good at it. And it kind of reveals that he had a very, very personal tragedy in his own family that was like really gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
It's very, very sad. And the premise of the movie is like really that.
And of course, Michelle Williams is caught up in
all of it. Of course, Michelle
Williams
is in it. And
my trauma queen.
And of course, she's Oscar nominated for being in the movie for 10 minutes. I'm obsessed. She's so good. But the kind of whole thing about that movie is that like sometimes you don't get over grief. Sometimes grief is all encompassing. It affects your life for like the rest of your life and you'll never get over it. Like it's really sad. Like some people.
Kenneth Lonergan.
Yeah. Some people really struggle with that. And I do think that there's a place for that in movies because there are many, many people that do not get over loss. And
absolutely.
So that I think is a good one. Ghost. Which
yeah,
I haven't seen
I haven't seen Ghost, but I know the scene.
Oh yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Do you know which one? Ordinary People.
Ordinary People, yeah.
We just watched that a couple months ago.
On a similar note, Rachel Getting Married.
Mm-hmm.
But Ordinary People is an Oscar winning role for Judd Hirsch, right? Did it win Best Picture also? Or did he not win?
I think he didn't win.
It won Best Picture.
The son won. He was the youngest at the
Timothy
time.
Timothy something.
Hutton?
Yes. Ordinary People was 1980.
Donald Sutherland was robbed.
He was robbed
of a nomination.
And who was the mom? Mary Tyler Moore. She was a little crazy.
She was not a little.
Yeah. And it was about. It was directed by Robert Redford.
Yes.
And it was about a family who's sort of getting over the
death of another son,
dealing with the death of one of their sons.
Mm-hmm. Yep. One that I think really stuck with me that I love, Big Fish.
I love Big Fish.
It's so good. Tim Burton.
It's a big time daddy issues movie.
But
it's done in like in my opinion, it's the best version of the Tim Burton style, like the fantastical style, because the entire movie is the dad kind of like on his deathbed, mm-hmm. retelling these big tall tales from his life.
Yeah.
And it's just
gorgeous movie.
And it's like the most Tim Burton-y movie you've ever seen. And as not a huge Tim Burton fan, that might have turned me off, but I loved it.
I loved it too.
It's like magical. Like it's like it like crackles with energy.
Yep. A few that we don't need to really discuss. Sixth Sense.
Yeah, we did already.
Coco.
Yeah.
That's obvious with there. The Descendants. If we're doing Alexander Payne, which we did with the Holdovers episode, because yeah. The Holdovers also covers grief.
I thought you meant Rotten to the Core Descendants.
No, not that one. The George Clooney Descendants, where grief is kind of complicated.
Yeah.
Because George Clooney's wife, spoiler alert, is dying.
Didn't we talk about this last week, too?
Yeah. And they're going through it in their marriage. So that's like really complicated. And I find that to be really interesting. And very kind of truthful, I think, to a lot of people's relationships.
For sure.
Which brings me to The Savages.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that movie? Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney are siblings, and their dad is dying, and they did not have a good relationship with their dad.
Well, the thing also with these movies that we're talking about is, like, not all of them are necessarily, like, depressing or sad. Like,
no.
I didn't find The Descendants to be sad. It's just a complicated movie.
Yep.
So I'm not saying... Like, you might be listening to this and being like, oh, like, why would I, like, want to watch a movie about grief? And, like, if you feel that way, don't watch Manchester by the Sea. But
don't watch Pieces of a Woman.
Right, right. But I find it really fascinating how some people are able to turn these into either entertaining movies like The Sixth Sense or, like, Hereditary is another one that yep. I would bring up. And there's ways to, it's like, that is where the creativity comes into it for mm-hmm. me. Not that Manchester by the Sea is not creative or art or anything like that, but I like to see when people can take an idea like this and sort of turn it into something, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be watchable per se, but like sort of adds a twist to it.
Well, and that leads me to my last one, which is not grief as far as death of a person, but death of a relationship in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
I wrote that one down as well.
There you go. What other ones do you have?
The only other one I have two that you didn't mention. One of them is an obvious one, Up.
Yes.
Which that's the whole movie. And The Others.
Yes.
Which is...
Spoiler alert.
We're not going to spoil The Others. The Others is great. I don't think enough people have seen The Others for me to just talk about it. But you should watch The Others. It's a horror-ish... It's like a ghost story movie with Nicole Kidman and her kids. And they live in a house. And she like... There's suddenly like a fog outside the house.
It's so good. It's very gothic. It's very like kind of spooky.
Yeah. For my leftovers heads out there, it's got Christopher Eccleston in it too.
Love that guy.
He's great. He was also the villain in Thor: The Dark World.
Okay. Anyway.
Okay. I've read Nancy Myers, director of The Parent Trap and The Holiday, mm-hmm. two movies which we've covered, described as the Pepsi to Efron, Nora Ephron's Coke. Do you agree? And who do you like more?
I think that's a mean way to put it. I think that they have different strengths.
I would argue that Pepsi and Coke have different strengths.
Yeah, I guess. I personally prefer Nora Ephron to Nancy Myers.
Okay.
Why is that? I love The Parent Trap. Don't get me wrong. But I find that some of Nancy Myers...
Why are you hating on The Holiday, bro?
I think that with The Holiday, and I think I've seen a couple other Nancy Myers movies.
Something's Gotta Give,
whatever. I just find that sometimes it leans a little far into the melodramatic, and I prefer the kind of fizziness and more kind of sarcastic side that Nora Ephron movies lean into a little bit.
Did you watch It's Complicated?
I did, and I did not love that
Father
one.
Father of the Bride?
I haven't seen Father of the Bride. I did like Something's Gotta Give, but again, I prefer When Harry Met Sally, which Ephron wrote.
Right.
And Rob Reiner directed, right?
He did.
Yeah. King. Reiner Hubby.
Reiner had a heater for like 5 years. It was like six movies back to back to back to back that were
all different.
All different, all amazing.
Yeah.
He was a mercenary director. He was doing all this crazy stuff, and he was like, it's his career is so strange because he did kind of nothing for a while. Then he was really, again, on a hot streak. This is Spinal Tap, Princess Bride, Misery, When Harry Met Sally,
A Few Good Men,
etc. Yeah. And then he's kind
of
done
Stand By Me. That movie's so
Stand
good.
By Me. And then he's kind of done nothing since, you know, nothing of note. So it's like kind of, it's a really, really, really weird career. But when he was at the peak of his powers, like he was in the time of When Harry Met Sally in 89, like you couldn't beat him.
Can't beat him. And I love Sleepless in Seattle. I love You've Got Mail. She has some that could have been, honestly, like, I feel like Julie and Julia could have been Nancy Myers. Like, there's some that kind of, you're like, oh, okay, I could see either way. But the hits that Efron has, I think, are higher for me than the Nancy Myers ones. However, if
like,
I'm...
Like Bewitched?
No, not like
Kidman
Bewitched.
And Ferrell?
No. I don't think... I, like, truly don't think that there's, like, a romantic comedy, like... king or queen
okay.
for me as far as writer and director goes. I do understand why people would compare or even confuse Nancy Myers and Nora Ephron.
Both of their first names begin with N.
True.
Doesn't hurt.
But
doesn't help.
I think I like Nora Ephron better.
Okay.
But I wouldn't necessarily say Coke and Pepsi like that.
Okay. Would you have a better comparison or just no? Just no comparison.
I would say like Rice Krispies and Cheerios.
Okay, they're both good, but in
they're
different
ways. They're both good, but you know, you always have a preference.
Yeah. I think I agree. I think there's more meat on the Efron movies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just easy to sit down and watch a Myers movie. And not that it's hard to sit down and watch this or watch When Harry Met Sally, but you know, there's more you need to devote more, I think, a little bit more brain power to those movies if you want to get the full experience than you do to The Holiday or Something's Gotta Give, which are, you know, two of the Myers movie and The Parent Trap.
I also feel like the Efron characters feel like real people a little bit more so than the Myers people.
Yeah. Myers also had Miles from The Holiday in her one of her movies. So,
and you hate that.
And I'm not a fan of that. Okay, what else we got? What makes Hanks and Ryan such a good combo? Because they were in Joe versus the Volcano. They were in this and they were in You've Got Mail. Is that it?
Yes.
Why them?
I don't know. I think... Number one, I find them to be boy and girl next door-ish,
okay.
Which I think lends people to feeling, you know, more likely to kind of be like on their side with things. I also think that they're unafraid to be kind of silly.
Yeah.
And I like that both of them can do that. If you look at You've Got Mail, which you haven't seen yet, we'll cover that eventually.
I'm sure we will.
They're both a little more buttoned up.
Okay.
Which is kind of interesting.
Is You've Got Mail another type of like communication movie like this?
So in You've Got Mail... Oh, get ready.
Just do a brief little...
In You've Got Mail, Meg Ryan's character owns this like sweet little independent bookstore. And she is like aiming with this guy... Who, like, she's like, oh my God, I love him, whatever. And he's like encouraging her to like keep going, whatever. But it's actually Tom Hanks, who is the heir to the Fox Books empire, which is like a Barnes and Noble, like big box kind of.
And they try to buy her out.
And they're trying to get rid of her.
I could write this stuff.
It's good stuff. And so it's that whole kind of back and forth where like
okay.
in person, they're like, meh, 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 meh.
Yeah.
But like they actually like each other.
You've Got Mail.
And then they kind of like each other in real life, too. So it's really cute. So I think that just them being able to be very... I don't know. They just have a little certain something about them.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't have an answer. I was just trying
They got that je ne sais quoi.
Yeah. I was wanted to see if you would be able to...
No. I just think that they're great together.
If anyone is listening to this and has a like a concrete opinion as to why Hanks and Ryan were such a successful rom-com couple, feel free to let us know because we want to know.
We do.
Now, we already talked about... Oh, we talked about realistic and unrealistic. What do you think this movie... What doesn't work for you in this movie? Anything?
The ending's not great.
Yeah, I agree. The ending, it's just... I'm okay with the anticlimax. I don't think that there's an issue with the fact that they don't kiss and they don't have the Hollywood ending.
I agree with that. I like that, actually.
I'm all right with that. I just don't like that, like, they, that awkward, weird standoff thing.
I find that throughout the movie, individually, their personalities are so buoyant and wonderful and fun. I would like to see that in that last little moment, that time where, like, maybe one of them cracks a joke.
I think if the movie were meant to have a message of something that's like a more of a negative message, or something that's like, oh, we should be worried about these two, then I think that the ending is appropriate.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the point.
Definitely not the point.
Right.
So I don't think that it landed right. I agree with you. Even if there was like a little moment, or even like some sort of reference to something that was said earlier.
Like this. Like, oh, she's kind of like, you know how she's looking through Jonah's backpack at the end?
Yeah.
Like if she pulls out an apple and she goes, you know, I can get rid of the skin in one go. Because right. That's something that his wife used to be able to do. And like, oh, he'll never find anyone who could do something like that. And she like references that.
Didn't he say that to Jonah?
Yeah, he said that to Jonah. But we saw earlier in the movie that Meg Ryan can do it.
No, I know that. But why would she wouldn't know that he said that to Jonah?
Well, no, because she would pull it out and be like, I love apples. You know I can do it with one thing. And then it'd be like, oh, wow.
Oh, I thought you meant like she'd be saying that as a joke to him.
No. She'd be saying it just like because she's funny Annie. Oh, and okay. She's quirky and like she does that. Okay. And then he would be like, oh,
I see what
wow.
You're saying.
You know what I mean? Like a cute little throwback to something.
And it would be like the Big Apple, Empire State Building.
See, look.
Oh, come on. That brings me to my last question, which is, do you think that they lasted forever, Sam and Annie?
I think they do.
Okay, why is that?
So I don't think it's for the reason that maybe the movie is putting out there. So the movie has this whole thing about like kismet and
magic
and serendipity and things like that and soulmates, right?
Yes.
Like Meg Ryan is convinced about Annie is convinced about soulmates and magic and all of that.
Poor Walter and his dehumidifier.
I know. Which is like so funny. Very relatable.
No joke. That's not a joke.
It's not. For me though, why I think that they have a good chance at lasting as a couple is because of what I've seen separately from these two characters. Tom Hanks's character, Sam, he was in a very successful marriage for all intents and purposes that we've seen. He was really in love with his wife. He'll always love his wife. She seemed like a wonderful person.
We see her in that one ghost scene.
Yeah. And it seems like they had a wonderful relationship. So clearly he has success in relationships. He knows how, like, to be successful.
He was successful with whatever her name was.
The other woman too. And then
he was successful because he wasn't really into her.
No, exactly.
Much.
Right. For Annie, yes, she wasn't super into Walter, Bill Pullman. But the relationship that we saw was pleasant and comfortable and very stable. And she,
until he met her family. And they didn't get the Lou Gehrig reference.
No, I know they should have. but she had a good relationship with him. It was just that spark wasn't there and she was looking for something else. So I think that, and she also knows how to pick good men. Like usually in these movies, like the original boyfriend, wow, he really stinks.
Rufus,
you know,
Sewell in the Holiday.
Right. It's like, oh, he's a loser. And so you're like, okay, well, does she just like, is that just an odd, not nice guy? Or like, what's the deal there? That's not a problem with her. She picks really nice guys. So I could see them lasting, not because of the magic, but because they both seem to be very stabilized, like good in relationships. And I think that it could work.
I'm going to go obviously with the other option because I think that's more fun for a podcast. I don't think that they're going to last. And that's, I'm thinking logically here. I'm thinking, what happens when they settle down and they're hanging out with each other all day, you know, and they're not, she's not talking to Jonah from across the country via letter. What's going to happen when he doesn't like the same movies as her, or when, you know, they don't like the same food or to go to the same restaurants, or, you know, maybe he wants to, for example, like golf and she wants to do something else and they can't agree on things. I don't think I've seen anything from the two of them to think that their personalities will necessarily mesh with one another. And I think Hanks is fine. I don't think we really know Sam, like, day-to-day, I'm happy life. We don't ever get to see that. I'm sure he's fine. Annie is also fine, but at the same time, what's going to happen when she's engaged again? You know, is she going to get cold feet again? Is she going to start thinking like, hey, maybe this guy's not for me? You know, I don't really like his kid. His kid's a weirdo. And also his friend Jessica is really weird and he needs to stop being friends with Jessica because she's influencing him poorly. Like, I don't know. Maybe I want to go back to Walter. Maybe I want the safe life. And then Walter's like, bro, like that was ancient history, man. I'm good now. I'm already married to this nice woman who has her own CPAP machine. And all is fine with us. But like, I don't know. I don't think I've seen enough that would make me think that the two of them would be able to settle down together and live and like do the day to day stuff.
I do understand that argument, especially because I think that movie love and a lot of times in real life, there's always this emphasis on wanting passion and, oh my gosh, tumultuous love that will like go through anything, to any fighting and any problems, to be successful, whatever. And it's like, we need to really like uplift boring.
Well, yes, that's also what Becky said. It is Becky, by the way, Rosie O'Donnell's character. She said something like, you're trying to get a movie romance and you're not, you don't want a movie, like,
right,
what you have right now is not a movie romance, so that's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And Becky also said something like, when you have chemistry with somebody, like, it could end up poorly, like her and Rick or whatever. Her, yeah, she's like, yeah. Oh, me and Rick hate each other. Like,
yeah, and that's like a joke that goes a couple times, recurring joke.
Yeah, but I agree with you. Uplift boring.
Yeah.
Be boring. We are boring.
We are boring. So.
Yes, that's all my questions. I will do my... I have one note, and it's just that I hope that Walter and his bedtime dehumidifier found love.
He did.
Roger Ebert gave this movie 3 stars out of 4 in his first review, though he eventually amended it to 4 stars out of 4.
Nice.
This is from his original 1993 3 stars out of 4 review. He said, when people meet... It's funny, because like in 1993, this was becoming a thing. But he's now... Obviously, it's way more prevalent now with like online dating and stuff. So he says, when people meet via computers or personal ads or phone-in radio shows, which like only one of those exists still... When their first sight of each other is through a communications medium, isn't it still possible that some essential chemistry is communicated? That the light in an eye can somehow be implied even over thousands of miles? That's the hope explored in Nora Ephron's Sleepless in Seattle, an unapologetically romantic movie about two people who fall in love from opposite sides of the continent through the medium of a radio program. And later on he says, the actors are well suited to this material. Tom Hanks keeps a certain detached edge to his character, which keeps him from being simply a fall guy. Meg Ryan, who is one of the most likable actresses around and has a certain ineffable Doris Day innocence, is able to convince us of the magical quality of her sudden love for a radio voice without letting the device seem like the gimmick it assuredly is. Sleepless in Seattle is as ephemeral as a talk show, as contrived as The Late Show, and yet so warm and gentle I smiled the whole way through.
Mm.
Which, yeah, I mean, you really got to get past the concept.
Yeah.
And the ridiculousness of the whole story, because it's told with a straight face too. You gotta mm-hmm. you gotta like take the extra step to get past it.
Right.
But I can see that. Trivia. While making the movie, Ephron was focused on its long-term legacy. She said, our dream was to make a movie about how movies screw up your brain about love, and then if we did a good job, we would become one of the movies that would screw up people's brains about love forever.
Spot on.
Yes. Tom Hanks simultaneously did voice work for this movie, or for Toy Story as Woody, and did the like on his days off from filming this movie.
Oh, fun.
Back in 93, or 92, I guess. When Meg Ryan's character is in the kitchen in the middle of the night listening to the best of radio callers, the caller, disappointed in Denver, is voiced by Nora Ephron.
Nice.
Casting was kind of crazy. Did you see some of the casting?
Yeah, Kevin Costner.
So Dennis Quaid was considered for the lead.
That was Meg Ryan's then husband.
And also Hanks and Rita Wilson were already married for 5 years at this point, and they played brother and sister in this movie.
Yep.
The role of Annie was originally offered to Julia Roberts.
Could see that.
Who turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Basinger was offered the role in the early script process, but turned it down because she thought the premise was ridiculous. other people who declined were Michelle Pfeiffer, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Jodie Foster. And then Meg Ryan landed it.
There you go.
And finally... who auditioned for the role of Jonah? Jason Schwartzman.
I saw that.
That's cool.
That is cool.
That's all I got for trivia and casting. Oh, I'll do my deep dive, which is... Okay. I have it here. It's an article, 2018, by Jen Chaney, who is a TV critic for Vulture. and New York Magazine. It's called Let's Reconsider Sleepless in Seattle from Walter's Perspective. As you know, I'm a full-throated Walter stan. And it's the article talks about, okay, she says, when we first meet Walter in Sleepless in Seattle, he is about to be introduced to Annie's family for the first time. Over Christmas Eve dinner, in front of the most uptight group of upwardly mobile white people outside of a Woody Allen film, Annie announces their engagement. Within seconds, Annie's father is already insisting that they get married in the garden at their house and laying out the entire reception menu. Walter is perfectly polite about all this, but make no mistake, he is already developing yet another allergy to everyone in Annie's immediate family. Do you honestly think Walter wants to be linked to these people for the rest of his life? Especially Harold, Annie's brother-in-law, who is deathly afraid of bees. Remember that?
I was obsessed with him.
He does not. After they fail to get his reference to the Lou Gehrig line from Pride of the Yankees, he realizes he actively hates every single one of them. But he says nothing, because he loves Annie and because Walter is a nice person, which was underrated in 1993. But now, in the nonstop meanness that is 2018, now 2024, may be the most appealing quality a man can possess. Poor Walter. He was kind before kindness became a rare and valued commodity. Walter also goes out of his way to make thoughtful but not disturbingly grand romantic gestures, like suggesting that he and Annie meet in New York City on Valentine's Day weekend, stay at the Plaza, and start their wedding registry together. Imagine having a man who wants to take you to the nicest hotel in Manhattan and also gets totally excited about shopping for China at Tiffany, then saying to yourself, "No, I really think a bereaved dude I heard once on a radio show is the one for me." Walter is far from perfect. He's admittedly pretty basic. Also, for some reason, he has no idea what dim sum is. But to be fair, Tom Hanks' Sam also has no clue what tiramisu is. Both of these guys are severely lacking in their exposure to even entry-level ethnic food. But Walter is actually there for Annie. Also, he's more alluring than you might think. As I learned from the movie Singles, if you tussle his hair and say, "There, now you look vaguely rockin'," Bill Pullman can suddenly become very sexy. Annie can never be bothered to tussle his hair. There are some who would say that Walter isn't really there for Annie because if he were, he would have picked up on the fact that she's extremely obsessed with a man who lives in a floating house in Seattle and taken immediate steps to put some excitement back into their love life. But I think Walter does pick up on Annie's weird vibes, but has enough confidence in their relationship to give her some space.
Well, he says something about it.
He senses that she's been distracted since Christmas, right, as he says when they reunite in the movie's third act, but senses that she's come back from wherever she was. She already said yes to his marriage proposal, so he shouldn't need to woo her at this stage in their relationship. If she has doubts, she should work through them and discuss them with him, but she doesn't, not for a while. She asks Walter if he ever gets nervous about getting married, and he says no, because Walter is never rattled by anything.
King.
She talks about the worst part of Sleepless in Seattle, which the movie only shows us in part. The moment when Annie finally calls off her engagement. I have to stress this. She's going to meet a man she still has not met and does not even know. And when she tells him, he has every right to go ballistic, pour the champagne over Annie's head, and start sobbing at the table. Instead, he says this: "I don't want to be someone that you're settling for. I don't want to be someone that anyone settles for. Marriage is hard enough without bringing such low expectations into it, isn't it?" He is calm. He is rational. He is more mature than anyone should ever be expected to have to be. "Walter," Annie says, "I don't deserve you." It is the most accurate statement Annie makes in the entire movie. And then, I mean, she says, even though Annie and Sleepless in Seattle treat Walter like complete garbage, don't feel sorry for the unluckiest man on the face of the earth. Again, that's the Lou Gehrig line. Jesus, how many times do Walter and I have to explain this? He may have gotten dumped on Valentine's Day in the middle of a fancy restaurant by a woman who decided he didn't match up to her fantasies. But the truth of the matter is, by not marrying her, he dodged a real bullet.
That is an excellent article.
I only read like probably a third of it. It's just a long article about Walter. Shout out to Jen Chaney from Vulture. I don't know if she still writes there, but 6 years ago, she wrote a really good article.
That's awesome. Justice for Walter.
Yes. I think that might be all I got. Do you have anything else?
No.
Oh, this movie has a great tagline.
Oh, tell me.
What if someone you never met, someone you never saw, someone you never knew was the only someone for you?
Good one.
That's the only tagline.
You don't need another
one. I think that's one of the ones that is like a classic. I've heard that one before.
It's a good one.
Yeah. So that's all I've got, tagline. Yeah. So does Sleepless in Seattle make Baby's First Watch List?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is like a one that you could put on whenever. This is not
it's a fun one.
Yeah, it's a fun one. I feel like when you're younger, again, I just literally just watched it for the first time like 3 days ago. But I feel like if I had seen this when I was younger and I was receptive to it, mm-hmm. not if I had blocked it out like a 14-year-old me would have. I think it's watchable without like really understanding the mm-hmm. intricacies of the grief and the relationships and all
I
that.
I liked it as a young teen.
Yeah. I mean, I would probably like the Rob Reiner parts and the Rosie O'Donnell parts too. Because those two are like, they're like the jokier parts of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, yeah, sure. Why not? There's nothing too crazy in this one that I would, not recommend. Yeah, so that is Sleepless in Seattle. Next week we have two episodes.
Oh my.
We've got The Mighty Ducks.
Okay.
The Mighty Ducks for all you duckheads.
I picked. I don't know why I'm acting like this.
The duckheads out there.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, neither have I. So
we'll see.
We'll see how it goes.
It did not do well on Rotten Tomatoes. Why do I pick all these like really bad movies?
Because you don't look them up first.
I don't look them up first.
And then also we're going to have a bonus episode for those of you who are interested in the Oscar nominations that come out next Tuesday, I believe, the 23rd. And we're going to have Uncle Nick P.
Woo!
Back on the podcast.
He's back.
Like we did last year, talking Oscar noms. And
he's back. He's more researched than us. He knows what he's talking about. And he's seen pretty much all the movies.
Yes. So you're going to get a lot of information from him. You're going to be a lot smarter by the end of it. No thanks to us. And yeah, so next week, tune in for Mighty Ducks and for our Oscar noms drop reaction episode. Keep sharing our clips and stuff on Instagram and TikTok and all that. And thank you for listening to Sleepless in Seattle. See you later.
Good night.
Bye.